We're going to continue our discussion with Sean B. Carroll about his work, The Serengeti Rules. Fascinating, isn't it? Haven't talked about this. And we're going to take your calls. And also, just as a little sidebar, if you want to share with us your weird whatever you ate story, go ahead and do that too. And welcome back to Coast, The Serengeti Rules. Okay, now, Sean, you got to tell us about your trip to Mozambique, why you even went there in the first place.
It's a great story, George. So, in southeastern Africa, it's on the coast. The country's twice the area of California, has 1,000 miles of coastline, but it's really had a rough few decades. After independence from Portugal in the mid-70s, they had a long civil war, killed about 1 million people, maybe left about 5 million homeless. In the center of the country, at least in the 1960s, was this beautiful national park, a gem that was, the jet-setters would go there. It's called Gorongosa. Had lots of lions, lots of buffalo, lots of elephants, huge numbers of hippos. Well, by the year 2000, there was almost nothing left. 14,000 buffalo were down to 50. 3,000 hippos were down to fewer than 20.
Wow.
A horrible situation. And Gorongosa, unfortunately, had been a battlefield for a lot of the Civil War. Well, an American philanthropist named Greg Carr heard about Gorongosa, heard about Mozambique's plight, and decided that he was going to commit himself personally and money that he made in the telecom industry to try to restore Gorongosa, to bring back this jewel and to bring back the safari and tourism industry in Mozambique and to help provide for the people around the Gorongosa area. So I went there last summer. And there were, in the year 2000, there were fewer than 1,000 large animals left of all kinds put together. All the antelope, all the elephants, hippos, all put together. And last year, there were 71,000.
Wow!
That's what happens when you give nature a chance.
It does replenish itself, almost like the planet does.
The habitat's there. You just have to take the pressure off, and they come roaring back. And so I saw giant groups of elephants with lots and lots of babies. I saw huge pods of hippos. I mean, just shoulder-to-shoulder hippos in the lake. And this is just roaring back. And it's a great story, and it's a great lesson. That's only a little over a decade. So, and we have stories like that. All the manatee in Florida is about to be delisted from the endangered species list. It's come back fivefold in the time it's been on the list. Grizzlies in Yellowstone are going to be delisted. Same thing, come back about fivefold. Sea otters were almost exterminated in the beginning of the last century.
That's exciting.
Down to maybe 1,000 otters left.
So there's hope for us.
To over 100,000.
There's hope for us.
Yeah, we just got to take the pressure off in places.
And before we go to calls, I've got to ask you then about Chapter 8, Another Kind of Cancer. What is that doing in this book? Tell me about it.
Well, draw a picture. So we understand, unfortunately, we probably all have experience with this through family and loved ones, that you know, cancer is when something grows out of control in the body. Well, the same thing happens in nature. There are things growing out of control. And what I mean by control, I mean just that. The things that normally keep a lid on, the numbers of something, has disappeared. I'll give you two examples. One I tell in the book from my hometown. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio, on the shores of Lake Erie. And some of you may remember that a couple summers ago, they had to shut down the city water supply because there was an algal bloom in the running the whole lakefront of southern Lake Erie. And some years, that bloom could be 100 miles long. And, you know, we've all seen it. We've all seen a lake fouled with green algae. Well, in the big Great Lakes, these can be, you know, enormous blooms. And what that is that's a simple creature, a green algae, growing out of control. And how it gets out of control is a couple of reasons. There's sort of too much food around for it in the form of fertilizer running off of farms. And there's not enough grazers in the lake. They've been overwhelmed that would normally keep those algae in check. So when you look around, some things are out of whack in nature. They're growing like cancers. I'll give maybe another example later. But that's the general idea, is that the numbers of everything in nature are controlled. And when those controls are broken, some bad things happen.
Sean, why does it seem, at least it does to me, that this planet, once you find it, might have a cure for every illness or ailment that's out there?
Well, I guess because nature's been experimenting for a tremendous amount of time, it is amazing that, you know, some of the most effective drugs we ever know, like aspirin, you know.
The willow bark. Yeah.
Yeah, comes out of nature. So, well, I'll tell you, you may not know this. This story's in the book. Statins. So we know them as, you know, Lipitor and all those.
Mm-hmm. Cholesterol eaters, as they say.
Yeah, they help us bring the cholesterol down. This is a drug that has radically changed the treatment of heart disease. It's put a lot of cardiac surgeons out of business. And that was a natural product. That was discovered in a fungus by a very clever guy named Akira Endo in Japan in the 1970s. And that founder drug, first discovered in a fungus, the first statin, you know, that's revolutionized medicine. Pretty amazing that you'd find such a specific drug.
Now, when you say it was in a fungus, was it in a mushroom?
Yeah, it was a kind of a blue-green fungus. It was the sort of fungus he actually found it on a fungus that was a mushroom like being sold by a street vendor in Kyoto. He surveyed thousands of specimens to try to see if he could find something. He had in mind, here was his thinking, as you know, penicillin comes from a fungus, from a mold.
That's right, on bread, right?
Yeah, and he thought maybe there's a fungus that will stop essentially cholesterol production. Now there's a longer reason for this that I could give. It was a reasonable idea, but he had to screen through thousands of strains of fungi that he collected from all over, and he found the magic one, and that of course changed medical history. But the whole story of statins, and you know, as I said, all the Lipitors and Levacors and all that kind of thing, all came, first of all, out of nature.
Boy, we've got one of our doctors who comes on, and he just hates statin drugs.
There's always been a bit of debate about it, but I'm on the side of the large-scale epidemiological studies show that, you know, a lot of people have benefited from statins.
Well, I think you're right. I think it's helped people with heart issues more so than people without any heart issues.
Well, that's I certainly know that data. That's for sure. Yeah. People that are already in deep trouble have had a major benefit from them.
Let's take some calls. We'll continue chatting here. Let's go to Virginia in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Virginia. You're up.
Hi. Good morning. I grew up in Honolulu, and I guess I just listened to people talking about food and everything. And the Kobe beef, I thought everybody knew that cattle are really grass eaters, not grain eaters. The cheap beef is they're fed grain, and they are penned up, they are pampered, they are fed a special diet of special grasses, and then the secret is they are massaged, and that tenderizes the beef. As long as they're well nourished and spoiled, I mean, not spoiled, but taken care of. But that's the way it goes. But that would take my appetite away if I had to pay hundreds of dollars for a steak, for one steak. But
expensive.
It's the grass-fed part. So there's no aging to the meat. I was wrong about that.
And I think there is some aging to that, without question. Why are some restaurants so expensive and others aren't? That's what I want to know. It's the same food, right?
Free market.
Let's go to Ryan in Beaumont, Texas, east of the Rockies. Hello, Ryan. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Good.
Tonight, I should say. Yeah, no, it's today. It's morning, huh?
Yes, it is.
All right, wonderful. I've eaten a few weird things in my time. I'm actually a traveling salesman, and my company's taking me all over the place. So every time I'm in a nice restaurant, I always try to eat something that I never would normally have the chance to. One of those things was a kangaroo tail burger.
Oh, my gosh.
And when I say it's the best hamburger I've ever eaten in my life, by far. A bison burger, you were talking about that earlier. That's phenomenal. If anybody ever has a chance to try it, don't be scared. It tastes way better than beef, by far. But kangaroo's got it topped.
Hesitant, Ryan, when you were eating the kangaroo tail? Were you a little hesitant?
I was a little bit hesitant, but it was at the same time, it was in a really, really fancy restaurant. I don't recall the name. It was in Chicago. And I said, I've got to try this. You know, it was, they didn't have it on the menu all the time. It was right there. I asked my my waiter, and he said everybody that's ordered it has raved about it, so I took his word for it.
Oh, my God. What did it look like? Did it look like a tail, or was it all chopped up?
No, it looked just like it looked just like a hamburger. You know, they ground it up. Just like
okay.
We, yeah, exactly. I mean, it looked just like a hamburger.
But you can get kangaroo filet. I'll tell you this story, Ryan. So if you have a taste now for kangaroo, it's routine on Australian menus. And I remember taking my kids to Australia, and it may have been one of my kids was maybe about his 10th birthday, and he wanted to have kangaroo. So he petted him in the afternoon, and he ate him at night. That's how it worked out.
Wow. That's another thing, Sean, I don't think I could eat.
Not the same animal, by the way.
I just have this disconnect. This visual aspect about me, and, you know, I just can't do it. People eat insects like crazy too, by the way. Ants,
yeah,
crickets, grasshoppers. I mean, they do it for protein, don't they?
Certainly do. No, they can be incredibly nutritious and really important parts of the diet and parts of the world. And you know, and I think you can probably get as used to it as you know, you and I might be used to eating, you know, crayfish and, you know, shrimp and things like that. It's kind of the same group, but it takes a little getting used to.
If anybody's eaten roadkill, check in with me, too. I'm not going to put you down. We won't ridicule you. I just want to know what you did and how you did it and what you ate. Kevin in Norwich, Connecticut is with us now. Hi, Kev. Go ahead.
Timey kangaroo downspurt. Good evening, George. And this, I got to say, George, you've done hundreds of phenomenal shows, but this has got to be in the top 10.
Good.
I wish that everybody in the world could hear this interview. Because it's stuff that isn't talked about enough in the media.
No, not at all.
In my opinion, and it all makes so much sense, the balance of nature. As far as things that I've eaten, the most unusual things I suppose I've eaten other than frog legs is bear and elk. And I realize there's probably a lot of people out there in the Pacific Northwest and in Canada and so forth that have eaten bear and elk, but both are delicious. It's too bad that we have such a chagrin many times. Like I noticed particularly here on the East Coast since I moved back east, people don't want to eat anything unusual. I say, you New Englanders. Of course, I'm a New Englander, so I can say that.
I mean, have you eaten frogs, for example, or turtles?
When I was down in Florida, I tried. My dad used to make turtle soup, and nobody would eat it.
I don't blame them.
I guess I really haven't, but I have had frog's legs, and I think that's about it. But I know the United Nations wants us to start eating more bugs, so we'll see how that works out. I wanted to ask our wonderful guests if you could talk for a minute about the monarch butterflies. We love them because they're beautiful. I guess I have a two-part question. Why are they important in the balance in this tapestry of nature that we're talking about, and are we learning much about where they're going or what's happening? And I'm thinking of milkweed. I learned recently that milkweed is very important to them. I guess they lay their eggs in it, I'm not sure. And with, you know, the growing up of cities and building apartments and highways everywhere, I have to suspect we have less milkweed than we used to. What do we know about the monarch, and why is it important?
Well, you got the story right. Monarchs, of course, they are beautiful butterflies, and they make this huge migration. And the migration spot is down in the mountains in Mexico. So that's been identified. And, in fact, I can recommend a beautiful film if you happen to be at...
They all go down there?
Theater. Well, no, they're all migrating south, but that's where the big aggregation is in Mexico. If you've ever seen pictures of just, you know, absolute hordes of monarchs, they're headed to Mexico, but they're generally migrating south, and there's some other places where they congregate, but the big place is in Mexico.
They won't be able to come back if we build a wall, will they?
Well, they do have
that rights. Was my political little slant there. Sorry about that.
But the disappearance of milkweed is a problem. So, yeah, they do lay their eggs on milkweed, and the caterpillars grow up on that milkweed, and they actually... that milkweed toxin, that milkweed that they eat, becomes part of the toxins that they use for self-defense. So the milkweed's a really important plant to the monarch. But milkweed have been disappearing because of the way, for example, we plant our crops that we with herbicides. We kind of kill off the milkweed as a pest. So there's been a little bit of now people being aware of this. People are deliberately planting milkweed to give the monarch sort of a way home. And the Mexico authorities are having to protect their big overwintering sites, but the monarch numbers have plunged. Now, just in the last year, it's reported that they bounced back a few fold. They kind of cross your fingers, but compared to a couple decades ago, monarch numbers are way down. So we're going to have to do something to bring them back, and that probably means planting milkweed deliberately and protecting their overwintering sites.
One of the most gorgeous insects I've ever seen.
Beautiful, and I can recommend a gorgeous film if you happen to see it in your local IMAX theater, wherever, called Flight of the Butterflies. It tells the story of discovering where the monarchs go in the winter, and it's just a beautifully shot film.
What happens in the cocoon, Sean? This metamorphosis of a caterpillar into a butterfly. What happens?
Isn't it spectacular?
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Funny enough, George, this is actually something that I, in my research laboratory at Wisconsin, studied for many years. Especially, for example, how those wing patterns are made in butterflies. And what's going on is as the creature is developing, as that caterpillar goes through several molts, it's building up its adult body parts inside where we can't see them. And there's a whole sort of chemical choreography going on, invisible to our eye, but detectable with tools that we have in the lab, that are laying down that pattern that we're going to see maybe a week later when that animal comes out of its chrysalis. So it's a pretty spectacular process of building a creature, essentially, you know, wrapped inside that cocoon. So when it emerges, you know, it's such a spectacular impression. But we've learned a lot in the last 30 years about how animal bodies are built.
That is amazing.
About the recipes.
Is the caterpillar hibernating when it's in the cocoon?
No, it's developing quite rapidly. So it's really in there working. That's a very busy time. So as a caterpillar, when it makes the cocoon, the chrysalis, it's pretty, you know, roughly a week it's going to be in that chrysalis form. You know,
it develops that fast?
Yeah, yeah.
Wings, everything.
Yeah, and then the wings just inflate. So the wings are really tiny. They're sort of everything's sort of packed, and it's sort of an unfolding when you come out of the chrysalis, and things literally inflate. So it's making sort of the miniature version that, you know, it's kind of like just add a little air to those wings, and then you got the big wing.
And how does the caterpillar? It's got a little brain, right? There's no doubt it's got a little brain.
Oh yeah, no, it's.
How does it react when it has wings? Does it remember when it was just a caterpillar crawling around? And is it now saying, oh, my God, I can fly? I mean, does it go through that?
That's a great question. I think that what you've hit on the head, this is one of the marvelous things in the animal kingdom we don't think enough about. The life of a caterpillar, first it develops from an egg, and then it's a very, very, something so small you probably would never have noticed it on a plant, but it goes through lots of molts before it's that big caterpillar that we might notice with striped. That's a totally different lifestyle, living on that plant, not flying, etc. Different kind of body, different predators, everything. And then when it comes out of that chrysalis, it's, you know, virtually a different kind of animal, at least a different kind of lifestyle.
That's right.
So it has to really have built a brain for two purposes. First, a brain that can, you know, live on a plant, spin the, you know, make the cocoon. And then a brain that can navigate vast distances as it migrates.
Oh, if we could only tap into that brain to see what that caterpillar butterfly was thinking. We're going to come back and take some final calls with Sean B. Carroll next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, some breaking news for you. Senator Bernie Sanders will win the Idaho Democratic caucuses, and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas will win the Utah caucuses. He needed that. So the horse race continues there. Hillary, I think this is my prediction, will get that Democratic nomination. So your delegate count is double that of Bernie Sanders. I still think it's a horse race for the Republicans, but we shall see. Hey, a little shout-out, by the way, to Barbie Kligman, the executive producer of ABC's Secrets and Lies, and her significant other, Billy Malone. Billy has starred in the incredible show Better Call Saul, the offshoot of Breaking Bad, and he's also working on a movie with Charlie Sheen on 9/11. Great people, by the way, in Los Angeles, listening to us on KFI AM 640. We're going to come back in a moment with final calls with our special guest, Sean Carroll, as we talk about the Serengeti Rules. That's his latest work, his book. Welcome back, Sean Carroll with us, of course, the Serengeti Rules. Let's review again the Serengeti Rules, what that means, Sean, and then we'll go to final calls.
Those are really rules that we've now discovered about how nature works really on a larger scale, particularly those rules that determine how much there is of everything out there, from lions on the Serengeti to the bugs on a rice field.
Is there one species that could take over the planet?
We already have.
It's us, isn't it?
It's us.
How did we get to the top of the chain?
Well, you know, we're a tool-making animal. That started somewhere a little over 2 million years ago in the Rift Valley in Africa, and that gave us a lot of mobility, a lot of adaptability to the kind of changing world, and we were mobile and twice left Africa, most recently about 80,000 years ago, and then we went out and covered the whole world, and wherever we went, we adapted. Cold climates, you know, in the north, tropical islands. It's pretty amazing as a species that we are able to, you know, go to Australia, go to South America, you know, colonize the whole globe. And that, you know, we live at high altitude. We live, you know, in cold and snowy areas. If you think about where all the indigenous people of the world have settled. A pretty amazing species, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, our ability to control our own environment through our intelligence and technology.
As a molecular biologist, are you seeing things change at the cellular level for the worse?
Not for humans. I mean,
all right, that's good.
We're living a lot longer on average than we did 100 so years ago, and no, I think, you know, my main concern in writing this book is that, you know, we haven't known a lot about nature until fairly recently, and the information we do have says we do have to change some of our behavior, as I said, for it to supply our demands. And I want people to have a better functional understanding of what's going on out there, whether it's just a local pond, you know, or a magnificent forest, that these places can be healthier and more productive than they are right now.
All right, let's go to Brendan in Idaho, first-time caller. Hi, Brendan, go ahead.
Yes, thank you so much for your show, George.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for supporting us.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you for your guest, too. Just had a quick comment and a question for your guest.
Okay.
The comment was really more of thinking, as I was listening to the show, I was thinking of a dialogue line in the first Matrix movie where Agent Smith is interrogating Morpheus and he's explaining himself from the standpoint of the machine world, where he says they were trying to classify humans, but they weren't really mammals. And then he went into his explanation of how creatures enjoy a natural equilibrium. Balance in nature, but humans don't. And we move to an area, multiply, and consume up all the resources, and the only way we can survive is to move to another area and do the same thing, and that those characteristics represent a virus. And so my question for your guest was, at what point does nature, Mother Earth, if you will, rapidly begin to go for the, you know, go try to get the balance back, after all the damage that we've inflicted on the planet. You know, Fukushima, obviously, the whole North Pacific is decimated, radioactive isotopes and the like, and so, and that's just one of many things. So I just wanted to ask that of your...
At all the planet...
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Look at all the planet killer asteroids we've had, Sean, or these extinct events, and the planet just keeps rebounding, doesn't it?
It does rebound, that's for sure. It's a great comment, by the way, that the Matrix segment was pointed out to me by my kids. By the way, the same thing occurred
yeah.
to them when we had this discussion, so it's an apt comparison. You know, normally, one of the major checks in nature is that when some population kind of runs out of control, it crashes. It runs out of food. We see this all the time. There are cycles of rabbits and lynx in northern North America and in northern Europe We've seen this, you know, many, many times. Now, of course, we're trying to, you know, we have a culture that, you know, hopefully prevents us from starving and from crashing. But that's really the way Mother Nature keeps other things in check, is that when they you know, kind of overproduce, famine is usually on the other end. I hope that's not what it comes to.
Let's go to Scott in Kansas. Hey, Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going, George?
All is well, Scotty. Thank you.
Hey, earlier tonight he's talking about cattle, eating cows and all that kind of stuff, you know, and all the, every creature has a purpose, you know, it's on the planet. Do you know what they do with the cow's blood after they process it at a processing plant?
That's an interesting take. I don't know. Sean?
No, I don't know.
Well, I haul blood from the southern Kansas to Nebraska every day from a packing plant. They take it out, they take it up there, they can separate your plasma from the rest of the stuff that's in the blood, and your biologist, Sean, can tell you what's all in it. If it's good enough, they clean it up good enough and sell it for pharmaceutical grade.
Oh, my gosh.
And it might go in hospital. Plasma's about all the same, they tell me. The rest of the stuff they use for dog food, makeup, all kinds of stuff, because it's all protein. So a cow, and they use every part of the cow for food or something else, you know, so.
Well, I can tell you that there's a, when the plasma's separated, that is used to grow cells in culture that are used, for example, in pharmaceuticals. It's a common, the way we grow tissues and cells in culture for to produce things or for research, we do use the cow plasma. So that is a important asset that we get out of the cow.
Linda in Illinois, it's your turn on Coast to Coast, Linda.
Hey, George, I love you guys.
Hey.
I got to tell you this. Number one, I have had frog legs and turtle deep fried. It's excellent.
Whoa.
No. You got to try it when it's deep fried.
I can't.
Sure you can. I don't like turtle soup. But the second thing is, my ex-husband and I, when we were going together, we'd been together, I don't know, 6 months or a year. We came from a real small town of about 10,000 people. And every fall, they have what you call a wild game feed at a bar. Okay, you can go in there and you can eat, you know, whatever you want, raccoon, deer, whatever. Okay, so we're sitting there and they brought us a plate of this stuff. And I went to pick up one piece, and I says, "What is this?" And he says, "Hush puppies." And I could tell by the smirk on his face that was not a hush puppy. I sat it back down on the plate, and I looked at him, and I said, "Okay, now, what is it?" He looked at me, and he just busted out laughing. Mountain oysters. No, I don't think so. I don't. George, do you know what that is?
I know. I'm not going to say.
Okay. Well, I was trying to be nice. You didn't say anything. I heard somebody laughing.
I found out about that in Boulder, Colorado, in the Denver airport on my way back from a Beyond Belief TV show, and they had it on the menu.
Oh, who would eat it?
Not me. Tommy did.
Yeah, and that was
Tommy fun. Ate it.
Yeah, he didn't even know
and
what
he was
eating.
They're laughing at me a while ago because I said that they tried to sneak them on me. He goes, "Oh, I got to hear this story," and he laughed.
I love it. Thanks, Teresa. I appreciate it. I guess people will eat anything, Sean.
Yeah, I lived 4 years in Colorado, and I learned what they were, and I avoided them.
Next up, Lulu's in Iowa, and now on Coast to Coast. Hi, Lulu.
Hey, about the monarchs, there is a great, it's the Register's Great, Register's Annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa. And you dip your rear wheel in the Missouri River, and you dip your front wheel in the Mississippi, and it's a different route across Iowa every summer. And in Mount Vernon, last year, I don't know who got the idea, but they made little mud balls with milkweed seeds in them, and the bikers were encouraged to toss them into the ditches along the roadways as they rode across the state.
Huh.
So to replenish, you know, the milkweed for the monarchs.
Great. That's a great story, and there's a big grassroots effort to plant more milkweed to help bring monarch numbers back. That's a great story to share.
Does milkweed not grow naturally, I mean, just by blowing around in the wind?
Oh, it does, but it's been killed off a lot by herbicides and by, you know, parking lots and everything else we put up. So
is it a weak plant?
Give it a little help.
Is it a weak plant, Sean, where it can get killed off quickly?
I don't know that it's any weaker than anything else. It's just something that, you know, you can imagine that farmers don't want to see that in their fields. And so it's been, reduced quite a bit, and that's just less food and less habitat for the monarchs.
Jeff is truck driving in California. Hey, Jeff, go ahead.
Hey, George, first off, let me say thank you for keeping me awake for 13 years while driving across the country.
Thank you. Thanks for keeping our country going.
You're welcome. Answers to both of your questions. Yes, I have had roadkill, and I killed it myself. Back then, it was legal to harvest.
What was it?
It was a deer.
Okay.
I hit it with the front of my truck, broke its neck instantly, so it was a quick death. CHP showed up, said, well, two options. You can pay to have it removed, or you can take it when we leave. I took it, we skinned it, processed it. I had free meat for 4 months.
What does deer taste like?
Oh, it's fabulous. It is I would have to say it's almost decadent. It has its own flavor, but it's the creamiest meat you'll ever eat if it's prepared correctly.
And it's like cutting through butter?
Oh, yeah. You don't need a knife to cut it. You can just use your fork.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Can't do that with a steak.
Oh, no. And the strangest thing I ever ate, my wife and I went with her parents to Namibia, Africa, on safari about 6 years ago, and we had giraffe.
Giraffe?
Giraffe.
What does that taste like?
Very gamey and oily. Almost like, I don't know, like a lower grade cut of beef mixed with duck.
Did you like it?
I was hungry, so I ate it. I don't know if I'd order it again, but it was most definitely a unique experience. And the side dish of the white ants, that was unique itself as well.
All right, thanks for the call, Jeff. Great stories. I don't know. I must be some kind of wussy or something, Sean. I don't eat any of this exotic stuff.
It must be the sauces. I think that's going to be the key to get through some of those meals.
After this program, we will all be very hungry or we're never going to eat again. I'm not sure which.
I'm going to count on everybody being hungry.
What do you think of molecularly changing an animal? There's a mixture now of animal and human chimeras. And what do you think of all that?
Yeah, I mean, we're not trying to create any kind of new beast. I mean, this is something that's talked about in the biology community a lot. I mean, I think that, we're certainly engineering plants for food. We could certainly imagine engineering livestock, pigs, cows, to change the quality of meat or milk. That's certainly within the range. We're very reluctant to go much further than that. So the technology is good enough to do the things that make a lot of sense sort of in the agricultural end of things, livestock, et cetera. But there's not really any purpose to make anything stranger than that.
All right, let's go to Teresa in Boulder, Colorado. Hello, Teresa.
Well, hello. I thought you missed me.
Nah, we knew you were there.
Oh, okay. Hey, I have a question.
All right.
You know, if we're all interconnected and every animal is important, we've had all of these extinctions going on, even today. Is it just the little animals don't affect the balance of nature? I mean, we kind of corral up the elephants and the tigers and
the big ones.
You know, so we're kind of taking care of them. We don't want them to get extinct for some reason, but it's like everything else that is. where does the balance of nature come in?
Yeah, well, here's the problem. The problem is that a lot of those big animals, you know, we're trying to take care of them, but they're disappearing from the wild, and that has really big effects. I'll just give you one example. In Africa, you know, the symbol of Africa is the African lion, and you got all these national parks in Africa, and you figure, hey, they're protected. Lion numbers have dropped from perhaps 400,000 50 years ago to about 30,000 today. And that has huge impacts because lions control a lot of things. So there are villages that are plagued now by baboons because there are not enough lions around, things like that. So your question was about the smaller animals. And I just wanted to make sure that even though we're kind of with, you know, sanctuaries and zoos and things like that, we're paying attention to the large animals. The large animals in the wild are still diminishing at an alarming rate. And on the smaller end of things, the big thing that happens there is just the total loss of habitat. When we clear a forest to put in a, you know, to make palm oil or something like that, everything's gone. The butterflies, the snakes, the ants, you know, birds, all that are depending on that habitat. So the small stuff is generally being taken out because the places where they live are being taken out, and the big stuff is being taken out because generally humans kind of exploit the big stuff at a disproportionate rate.
Favorite creature of all times for you, Sean? What is it?
Oh, people are going to be saying the favorite group of creatures are snakes. It's how I...
Oh! What a way to finish the interview. Snakes. All right, Sean, keep in touch with us, okay?
Thanks so much.
This was your fun interview, and it's great information. And up next, we're going to talk about moon mysteries. What the heck has been going on the moon? Stay tuned for that on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. You can do that quite often. You'll get some great information. And then also sign up to get our free newsletter. It's called the Coast Zone Newsletter. That's available digitally for free. Go take it.